I'm gonna make it as unnoticeable as possible.
Been looking around with like. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, I've.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
People just.
I mean, the pockets are still in the. Yeah, I might.
Actually, you're almost.
Yes.
When you.
My nano fiber order.
Okay.
I can see your.
At the seams? Oh, it's probably just.
But.
It's probably easier to leverage it.
But, like.
Actually, I'm.
What?
My nano fucking. I'm not.
It's like doing surgery.
Couldn't go.
I understand.
It's my.
First left. We call it, like, it's a change, it's a better approximation.
Oh.
No, it's the nano.
You would expect it to change.
I have a border of so long square.
Wait.
Oh, it changes.
And it's just between a puppy and an animal. I have a puppy which you haven't seen, and maybe.
It just changes your term of your matrix.
And then you calculate the margin by my nano.
If I don't give it a.
I have also seen.
Yes, so if like it gets really cold, I'll wear a puppy.
Oh,
it's super warm.
It is very warm.
It's super, super.
You took it out of the.
Yeah, it like equals awesome.
Yeah.
Yelling up for the season.
My kitten ran out last night.
It's an awesome.
Well, so probably my car, so my bed, okay.
Sure, so.
Well, I. You don't do that, that was a shed in the classics, yeah. My room, I have like my bed, and then the vent, and then the wall. And so.
Yeah, that's.
But then.
Yeah.
One of the things why I have the factors that I couldn't normally or bigger with the group.
Why could you not do that?
One of these sort of faces that is easy to see. It's not difficult to prove that.
Yeah.
But not the end.
That's awesome.
I love, I guess the way that did it, because I didn't need any combination.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I think it's time to get started. So first I want to apologize for the confusion I have, little confusion I have made yesterday with this RG flow equation for the nonlinear sigma model. Well, there was no mistake really, I just did something that was unnecessary. I tried to make T dimensionless, which just gave confusion. So, I mean, you can just correct this equation in the following way. So, almost everything is fine except here. So, I also have a factor of lambda, which is the cutoff to the power epsilon, and then t squared. So, you know, I just wanted to basically remove that factor, lambda to the epsilon, by making t dimensionless. You know, t has dimensions of minus epsilon, but then, you know, this only created confusion. So, in there is no real need to make t dimensionless. The equation can just look like this, and then everything is fine. So the dimension of t is precisely minus epsilon, the coefficient of the leading term on the of the beta function on the right hand side, and then everything is fine. Right. So this is t squared, this is lambda to the epsilon. So the dimension of this term is also minus epsilon. So there's no issues. Okay. Okay. So now let's just make this correction. I guess this corrects also the value of the fixed point by this factor of lambda to the epsilon, right? So the fixed point is going to be n minus 2 kd lambda to the epsilon. Okay. So now let's continue with the case of n equals 2 in two dimensions, right? So okay, so last time we found the energy of a vortex in our system, right, by minimizing this continuum Hamiltonian. So J over 2 d to x grad theta squared, right? So if you minimize h, so set the variation of h with respect to theta to 0, we find that theta has to satisfy Laplace equation. So Laplacian of theta is equal to 0, right? And so, you know, one way to think of what we did is the following. So, so the point is that the solutions of Laplace equation in two dimensions, when theta is a compact field, which is defined from 0 to 2 pi, right? So those solutions can be can have topological classification. So namely, we can have, so for any loop surrounding the origin, right, the integral of gradient of theta dot dl, the circulation of the gradient of theta around this loop, can be equal to 2 pi times an integer, okay? So all of such different solutions are solutions of these Laplace equations. They all have different energy, of course. The energy increases as I increase m, from 0 to 1 to 2, right? But all of those are solutions of this equation, which are local minima of the Hamiltonian, right? And they have this topological classification. So different solutions are classified by this integer n. So when n is 0, you simply have uniform state with theta uniform everywhere. There is no there are no vertices. N equals 1, we have one vortex with winding number 1, and so on. Okay? And so then we have found that, that the energy of a vortex with winding number n, let me call this E sub V. Well, actually, there is no need to have sub V, it's just E, is equal to pi j n squared log of L divided by A, right? Where L is the system size and A is the microscopic length scale, which is of the order of the Lysis constant. Yeah.
From this analysis, how do we tell where the vortex is centered? Like, where's the vortex?
Well, we have, no, so we have, I have centered the vortex explicitly at the origin to find the solution. But you're right. I mean, it can be centered anywhere. I can put the, since the I have just an infinite 2D plane, I can put the origin anywhere. Okay. And that's actually precisely going to be the next thing. So clearly, you know, at if I have t equals 0 at 0 temperature, vortices will not appear, right? Because they cost infinite energy, right? However, if I raise the temperature now, so if t is greater than 0, then what I have to minimize to find the equilibrium state of the system is the Helmholtz free energy rather than energy. And the Helmholtz free energy is equal to E minus Ts, okay? So which means that at high enough temperature, if the entropy associated with the appearance of vortices is high enough, it can be favorable from the point of view of minimizing the free energy to actually have vortices, okay? So what would be the, how would we estimate the entropy associated with vortices, right? So what is entropy? Entropy, as you know, is given by, well, assuming KB is equal to 1, is basically equal to log of the number of states, right? Let me call this gamma. So in the case of vortices, the number of states is just the number of places I can put the vortex core at, right? And this is going to be log. So this number of places where I can put the vortex core at will be the number of plaquettes, the number of elementary square plaquettes in my lattice, right? Which is equal to you know, the area of the system, L squared, divided by area of a single plaquette, which is A squared. So I get log of L divided by A squared, or twice log L divided by A. And so the same, exactly the same logarithmic factor appears here, okay, in the entropy. And so therefore, if I calculate now the free energy, So I'm going to have pi j squared, and let me consider vortices with the lowest energy cost. So I will put n equal to 1, right? Let's set n equals 1. So I have pi j squared log L divided by A, and then minus 2t, the same log L divided by A. And so you see that when temperature is greater than pi j squared divided by 2, right? Sorry, there is no j squared. There was n squared. So pi j divided by 2, right? It becomes favorable from the point of view of minimizing the free energy to actually have vortices in the system. Okay? And so this temperature is called Kosterlitz Thouless transition temperature, and the corresponding transition between a phase with no vortices and a phase with free vortices is called Kosterlitz-Thouless transition. Okay? So this is kind of a simple hand-waving explanation for why a transition happens in the system. Okay? And we will, of course, do a more sophisticated analysis just a little bit later. Okay?
Anton.
Yeah.
Anton, could you explain again why the number of states is elaborate? I understand this is the number of plaquettes in the system.
Yeah, so it's just the number of places where you can put the vortex in, right?
Oh, I see. Okay.
If my system is infinite, all plaquettes are equivalent. So I can place, I place this vortex to calculate the energy at the origin, but the position of the origin can be anywhere, right? So all of those states correspond to the same energy. Well, yeah, in this case, it doesn't matter. I mean, I can just assume that I have an infinite 2D plane. As I mentioned, this is really kind of very good question. Yeah.
So when we calculated the energy of the vortex,
mm-hmm.
That relied on there just being one of them, right?
Yeah.
So can we interpret this as saying that it's favorable to have more vortices? Or it seems like if you were to add a second one.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, of course, I mean, this is, as I was saying, this is just a very simple hand-waving argument. So what this is saying is at a certain temperature, you would want to produce vortices. So what really happens, as I mentioned already before, and as we'll describe precisely in what follows, so what really happens is that, so even below this temperature, we have vortices. There are vortices at any non-zero temperature. However, those vortices are bound into pairs, right? So, I can call this N here a charge of the vortex. In fact, this analogy with charges will be very, as you see, is very precise. So I can call this N a charge of the vortex, right? And so then it turns out that below Kosterlitz-Thouless temperature, all the vortices are bound into charged neutral pairs, right? So if you have a vortex somewhere where N is equal to plus 1, there will be a vortex nearby with N equals minus 1, right? And so then the total winding number of this dipole of vortices is 0, right? If I calculate that integral over a contour, which over a loop which encloses both vortices in this pair, right? The winding number is 0. Okay, and then the energy of this pair of vortices, it can be estimated just from this expression, is basically proportional to J times log of the distance between the vortices, right? Okay? I mean, it's just an estimate up to a prefactor. So what happens is that, so those vortices are always bound below TKT, but then the distance, the average distance between the vortices in those pairs, in those neutral pairs, increases as T approaches TKT, and eventually diverges as when we are above TKT. Okay? So this is what happens. And so then at the Costa-Lethalis temperature, the vortices unbind. Yeah?
Could you have charged neutral triplets?
Well, yeah, you can, but it's just that, you know, we basically don't have to consider vortices with higher charge because they cost more energy. So everything is determined by vortices with the charge plus or minus one. Those appear first. So basically, you can think of this transition, the Costa-Lethalis transition, is a vortex deconfinement transition. So below TKT, vortices are confined into charge-neutral pairs, while above TKT, those vortex charges are liberated, and they can exist by themselves freely. Okay?
You said the separation diverges as you approach TKT?
Yeah. So now the question is, how do we describe this transition now? Okay, so the problem is that all the phase transitions that we talked about before have description in terms of order parameter, right? Where order parameter is basically coarse grained but still local variable. Okay, it's an average of the microscopic spin, right, over some relatively small distance. Problem is that here clearly the relevant variables are those vortices, right? But the problem is that if I try to describe a vortex in terms of my original variables, for example, those angles theta, right, a vortex in terms of those variables is an infinite object, right? It has a point-like core, but in principle, a vortex involves some infinitely large configuration of thetas. Right? And what's even more complicated is that, you know, what really defines the vortex is that number n. Right? So in this sense, all the vortices with where I just smoothly change theta without changing this number, all of those configurations are in a sense equivalent. Right, so there is an infinitely large number of configurations of theta, which corresponds to a particular n. Okay, so that makes a description in terms of theta extremely complicated, basically impossible. So we have to somehow pass from the variable theta to the variables that describe somehow those vortices. Okay. And so it turns out that it's possible to do that, and the procedure is called duality transformation. Okay, so I'll first describe this procedure in a kind of hand-waving way, and then we will do a rigorous transformation. Okay. Physically, the idea of this transformation is based on analogy between vortices and charges, okay? So, or analogy with electrostatics. Electrostatic analogy, okay? The idea is the following. So, as I said, a vortex is an infinitely large object, right? It has a point-like core, but we can see the presence of the vortex infinitely far away from it, from the core. So it's kind of similar to an electric charge, right? If I have an electric charge somewhere, it's point-like. However, I can detect its presence, right? If I calculate flux through any surface which encloses the charge, right? If I have, if I calculate flux of the electric field through any such surface, right? And so this picture is clearly similar to the picture of a vortex which I drew before. So this suggests that we can use this kind of analogy to electrostatics in describing vortices. Okay, so let me define analog of the electric displacement field D for vortices, and I'll define it in the following way. So I'll call this field D just the same way as in electrostatics, and I'll define this as gradient of the phase theta cross z, where z is going to be axis that's perpendicular to this plane. Okay, so we are considering a two-dimensional system. I assume that it's in the xy plane, and the z axis is transverse to it. Right. So gradient of theta is transverse to the direction of the vector m. Right. Right. So therefore, d is actually along the vector m. Okay. So if I draw this vortex configuration of the vector m, so I'm going to have grad theta in this direction. And theta, and therefore d will be precisely along the direction of m. Okay. Now, so if I calculate now the divergence of d, right? So as you know, in electrostatics, Maxwell equations, the divergence of d is equal to 2 pi times the charge density in two dimensions. Okay. So divergence of d from this definition is going to be equal to divergence of gradient of theta cross z, right? Now, divergence of gradient of theta cross z, I can rewrite as a curl of the gradient of theta. So normally, you know, for a well-behaved function theta, curl of a gradient would be 0. But in the presence of such singularities, in fact, it's not. Right? When you have sources of the field gradient theta, the curl is not 0, and it's precisely equal to 2 pi times m times the delta function, right? So delta of x, assuming that the location of the singularity is at the origin. Okay. And n is the Weising number. So here you can clearly kind of see the analogy of between this Weising number and the electric charge. Right?
I guess it's the shape of the curve.
Sorry?
This is the shape of the curve. Not the curve.
Well, it's not. So it's the, I guess it's the, sorry. So it's in two dimensions. So it's the z component of the, yeah. So I should write it like this. It's the z component, well, because curl is a vector, right? So it's the z component of the curl of the gradient. Yeah, thank you. Okay. And so if I now take a loop, any closed loop which encloses that vortex, right, and I calculate, so integral over the area enclosed by the loop of the curl of grad theta z component d to x, so I can use Stokes' theorem, right, to rewrite this in terms of circulation of grad theta around the loop itself, right? So this is equal to dot dl, and so this is 2 pi m, right? So everything is consistent here. So if I have, so if I take my solution, therefore, of the Laplace equation corresponding to a vortex, then I'll have grad theta equals phi n divided by r, right? And then, so if I calculate now d from here, this just gives me r hat n divided by r, right? This is precisely electric field of a point charge in electrostatics, right? Okay. Okay, now let me continue with this analogy. So let me define a dielectric constant, epsilon, which is going to be 1 divided by 2 pi j. Okay? So then d is, as you know, is equal to epsilon times the electric field, right? And then I can rewrite my energy in the following way. So h is equal to j divided by 2 integral d to x grad theta squared, right? I can rewrite this as just electrostatic energy, right? So if you plug everything in, it's going to be just 1 divided by 4 pi integral d to x d dot e.
Sorry, what is the vector e?
Sorry?
What is the vector e?
E is the, so this is electric displacement vector. This is the electric field, right? And this is the corresponding dielectric constant.
All, everything else?
Sorry?
So it's just a rescaling of D.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, yeah. So electric field is related to electric displacement by multiplying by this constant. Yeah, in this context, it's just a rescaling of D, right? The electric constant. Okay. So then from this electric field, I can calculate an electrostatic potential that's created by a vortex, right? Or, well, quote unquote electrostatic potential, just potential energy. So the electrostatic potential of a vortex is going to be, so u at some point r, right? So to get electrostatic potential, I have to integrate minus, so from some distance a, which is of the order of the Lattice constant, to r, right? E dot dr prime. Right? So then if I plug in this solution here, I get so minus 1 divided by 2 pi j integral from a to r m divided by r prime d r prime, right? And so this gives me minus m divided by epsilon, right, log of r divided by a. And this is precisely the Coulomb potential in two dimensions. And so using this, I can now write an potential energy of interactions, of interaction between an assembly of vortices. Okay? So the interaction energy for many vortices is going to be U, right, equals so minus 1 over 2 epsilon, 2 here just to correct for double counting of pairs, sum over I and j, sum over all vortex pairs, the product of the charges, right, log xi minus xj divided by a, okay? And so this is nothing but interaction energy of plasma of charges in two dimensions. Okay, it's plasma because the total vorticity has to be zero, right? So because the vortices are always created in pairs with corresponding anti-vortices, so the total vortex charge is always zero, right? So it's a plasma. So interaction energy of plasma. In two dimensions, okay? And so then the point is that this plasma of charges, which interact with a Coulomb interaction, can exist in two phases, right? So when T is less than TKT, then all the charges in this plasma are bound into neutral dipoles. And the plasma overall is insulating, right? Because the positive charges, if they move, they always move in pairs with negative charges. So the total charge transport is going to be zero. Charge, the plasma isn't insulated. So this plasma is insulating, which is the same as, you know, vortices being bound with anti-vortices. Are bound to anti-vortices. However, at high enough temperature, so when T is greater than TKT, those charges unbind, and the plasma becomes conducting. Okay? This vortex anti-vortex plasma becomes conducting. I should put insulating and conducting in quotation marks. These are not real electric charges. Again, these are topological charges representing winding numbers. Plasma becomes conducting. Okay? Yeah?
One question. Why do the two vortices have to be created as a pair of opposite charge?
Well, you know, because the energy to create a single vortex would be infinite, right? So what happens below TKT, right, is that the vortices are created along with anti-vortices. The energy of such a pair is finite. It's just log of the separation. Okay, so they can only be created below TKT in such neutral pairs.
Is the total n, or just for one, for the
n? I mean, so that was just electrostatics of a single charge, right? Single
in
vortex.
The energy
that's just the single vortex. But from that, I derived, you know, if I so I can find a potential that's created by a single vortex, right? Which is this U, and from that I can find how vortices interact between each other. If this is a potential created by a single vortex, right, then to find energy of interaction between this vortex and some other vortex, I just have to multiply this potential energy by the charge of this other vortex. Okay.
However, I think if I make the analogy with this case of electrostatics, right? The creation of two vortices, a vortex and an anti-vortex, the same as having two charges of opposite charge. So the field lines are stronger between the two charges, but there are still field lines all over the space, right?
Right.
So if I create two vortices, a vortex and an anti-vortex, then the whole system knows that those two vortices
sure.
were created.
Yeah, but it's exactly like that. So this pair of vortex and anti-vortex is like a dipole, electric dipole. So if you go far away from it, then you know the total, and you take a close surface that encloses the dipole, the flux of the electric field through this surface is going to be zero because the total charge of the dipole is zero. Although you're right that if you are close, then you will see that this dipole actually consists of two charges. Right? And if you make a closed surface that encloses just one vortex in that pair, then there will be flux.
So in here the energy to create a single vortex is like the self energy of a charge.
Okay. So this is still kind of a hand waving picture, right? Because I'm just assuming, again, that the relevant degrees of freedom are somehow only vortices, right? And I can think just in terms of vortices. But so this can be made rigorous, okay? And then the way to make it rigorous is duality transformation. So now let's go to the rigorous derivation of this. Okay.
Put the board up completely, please.
Sorry?
Can you put the board up? No problem.
Oh, okay. Okay.
If you define your epsilon upside down.
Sorry?
Is your epsilon defined upside down?
The epsilon.
Is
it defined?
There's some sort of inconsistency on the board, especially in the last slide.
So I have E. Yeah. So this should just be this is either 2 pi j or 1 over epsilon. Yeah, sorry. Okay.
So then,
it's just a way to remove this thing, right? This constant in front. Okay. So let's talk about duality transformation that makes this whole picture completely rigorous. Okay. So let me start. Not from this continuum limit of my model, but from the original microscopic model, where I have two component spins on a square lattice in two dimensions, right? So I have minus j sum over I and j, nearest neighbor, cosine of theta I minus theta j, right? And so in principle, the problem is solved by calculating the partition function, right, which is equal to integral from 0 to 2 pi over every angle theta, right? So product over I d theta I e to j divided by t sum over I and j cosine theta I minus theta j, okay? Now let me change the notation a little bit, which is going to be more convenient for this calculation. So these thetas are defined, as I said, on a square lattice in two dimensions. Okay, and so the sum here is over nearest neighbor sides. Okay, which I can rewrite as sum over sides, and then bonds attached to every side, right? So I can assume that to every side I am attaching, so let's say this is side I, right? To every side I have two bonds attached, a bond in the x direction and a bond in the y direction, right? So in this way I will count all the bonds in the system, because for example this bond is going to be just attached to this side, okay? And so then let me rewrite this sum over I and j as sum over I and then mu, where mu is going to be the two directions on the lattice, x and y. Okay? And it's also convenient to introduce a nicer notation for this difference, right? So since this is the difference between values of theta on neighboring sides, I can just write this as a lattice gradient, right? This is basically a discrete representation of a gradient of theta, right? So I will write theta I plus mu minus theta I as delta mu theta I. So this will be a gradient of theta I in the mu direction, okay? Component of a gradient of theta I in the mu direction. Okay, so then this partition function I can just write in the following way as integral from 0 to 2 pi product of d theta i's e to j over t, then sum over I and mu cosine delta mu theta I. Okay. Now, okay, so this, so let's look at this function, which we are integrating. Okay, let's even look at, so clearly this function just contains of products, right, of exponentials for each I and mu. So let me just look at one such exponential, so e to j over t cosine delta mu theta I, right? Now, so clearly this function is a periodic function of delta mu theta I, right? Because delta mu theta I is under cosine. So this is a periodic function with period 2 pi, okay? So since it's a periodic function, I can expand this function in Fourier series, like any periodic function. So I can write formally this thing in the following way. So sum over some integer m, I mu, I will explain what this notation is in a second, going from minus infinity to infinity. So e to I m I mu delta mu theta I, and then f, which depends on m I mu, okay? So these integers, m I mu, so they are now defined on bonds of the lattice, right? Because the argument of the cosine here lives on a bond of the lattice, which is labeled by I and mu, okay? And so therefore, those integers are defined on bonds, so m I mu is defined on bond I mu, okay? And f of m I mu is the Fourier transform of this function, whatever it is, right? So we can calculate this Fourier transform formally. Here is this. So I can calculate f of mi mu by just inverting that that Fourier transform, right? So f of mi mu is going to be equal to, so 1 over 2 pi, 1 over the period of this function, integral from 0 to 2 pi dx, right? E to minus m I mu times x, right? And then the function, so e to j over t cosine of x. Okay. So this integral happens to be a known special function. This is just a definition of a special function, which is called modified Bessel function of degree mi mu of this prefactor here of j over t. So this is called I m I mu of j over t. Okay, so this is modified Bessel function . It's a well-known special function. You know, it's going to be a built-in function in Mathematica. So everything is fine. Yeah, as long as my Mathematica has it, then it's well known. okay? But so, of course, you know, this is just an exact rewriting. So for us, this doesn't really help much. But what will help is the following. So now I'm going to use an asymptotic form of the function I at large values of the argument. I'll justify this in just a second. So I am I mu of x happens to have a very simple asymptotic form at large values of x. Okay. So it's approximately equal to 1 over root 2 pi x e to so x minus m I mu squared divided by 2x. Okay. And so this is valid at in principle at large x. However, you know, even quantitatively, if you plot this function, the exact modified Bessel function in Mathematica, and then plot this approximation, it's actually excellent approximation, even quantitatively, for, you know, down to x equals 1. Okay, but the point is not even that. The point is the following. What we want to preserve here, you know, in according to our philosophy of universality, right? What we want to describe is really universal properties of this Costa-Lethalis transition. In this sense, you know, any function which has the same symmetries and the same properties as e to j over t cosine x will do, right? And so, in particular, the most important property, as far as describing the vortex physics is concerned, is precisely that periodicity of e to cosine x, periodicity with period of 2 pi. And so, this approximation to the Fourier transform of this function preserves the periodicity, okay, which we'll see in just a second. Okay. Well, basically, it's obvious because, you know, because the periodicity lives here. Periodicity is in this prefactor. It's not in the specific form of the Fourier transform. So as long as I don't take something crazy for this Fourier transform, it's basically going to work. Okay? But here we are, in fact, taking a very very good, even quantitative approximation to that function. Okay. Okay, so if I use this approximation now, I'll get the following result for this exponential. So e to j over t cosine of delta mu theta I is going to be approximately equal to root of t divided by 2 pi j. And as you can guess, this prefactor is gonna disappear because we've already done some violence to the cosine. Neglecting the prefactor can't hurt anymore. So e to j over t, and then sum over m I mu from minus infinity to infinity e to I m I mu delta mu theta I, and then minus t divided by 2j m I mu squared. Okay, so this sum is the important piece. So that's precisely what preserves this main property of this function, that it's periodic in the variable delta mu theta I with period of 2 pi. Okay. Okay, so let's now rewrite the partition function in this way. So let me lower this thing and erase. Okay, so then the partition function for the XY model takes the following form. Z is equal to integral from 0 to 2 pi product over I d theta I. And then in addition to that, I have sum over, the price I pay now is I've introduced a new variable, right? Before my variables were on the thetas, now I've introduced a new variable, which is this integer m, okay? So sum over all possible m's for every bond I mu, so I'll write this as just sum over all, sum over the set of m's on every bond, right? And then I have, e to minus t divided by 2j, So sum over I and mu, m I mu squared, and then plus I sum over I and mu, m I mu delta mu theta I, and I have neglected the prefactors. Okay. So this is called a Villain representation of the partition function of my original XY model, right? So sometimes, people use the jargon that we've villainized the cosine. Okay? So this is called villainizing the cosine. And so if you look at this, it actually looks like very much like a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation that we've had before, right? So Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation just transforms something that's non-linear in a particular variable to something that's linear, right? So this is just a version of a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation for a cosine, basically. Okay? Okay, and the point of this is precisely the same as for the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, right? So what Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation allows us to do is to get rid of our microscopic variables. So here, I want to now get rid of thetas, right? I want to do this integral over thetas now, right? And I can do that because the it's just a simple exponential over exponential of that variable, right? So this integral can be done exactly. Okay. Now, so what is this integral equal to? So I will cheat here a little bit. I'll cut corners. So I will use an analogy of this discrete sum to what it would be in a continuum. Okay, so you can perhaps do this calculation more precisely in tutorial if you are not satisfied. But I think you should be satisfied. So I'll use analogy of this sum mi mu delta mu theta I, right? So in continuum, I would write this, so not equal, but let's say equivalent to integral d to x, right, of some vector m dotted with the gradient of the field theta, right? So now I can use integration by parts on this integral, right? I can write this as integral d to x of the divergence of the vector m times theta, right? And this, so this integral of a divergence over volume, as you know, can be transformed into an integral of the vector itself over the boundary. And I will assume that I can just ignore this, right? Or, you know, I can use periodic boundary conditions, so I can make my 2D plane a torus, in which case there is no boundary. So this just vanishes automatically. Okay? So this I ignore, and then minus integral d to x of theta, right, times the divergence of m. Right. Which, going back to my discrete notation, would be equivalent to minus sum over I and mu, right, theta I, and then delta mu m I mu, okay, where delta mu mi mu means precisely the same thing. So delta mu, as for theta, this is equal to m I plus mu mu minus m I mu. So this is discrete derivative of m. Okay. So then this integral, so integral of from 0 to 2 pi, let me take this integral for a particular I and mu. So integral from 0 to 2 pi d theta I of e to I m I mu delta mu theta I is equal to integral from 0 to 2 pi, well, not equal, transformed to, because these equalities are satisfied when I sum over I and mu. So from 0 to 2 pi d theta I e to minus I theta I delta mu m I mu, right? And this is nothing but a representation of a Kronecker delta of delta mu m I mu, right? This is just equal to up to factors of 2 pi, which are not important. This is equal to Kronecker delta of delta mu m I mu. Okay, so basically this integration over theta simply gives us an additional constraint on the variables m, right? So if you think of what this constraint means is that the divergence of vector m at every point on the lattice has to be equal to zero, right? So if you think of this M as some current, quote unquote, then this is simply current conservation. Okay? It's just conservation law for whatever is represented by the variable M. Okay, so let me lower this thing. So I get my partition function now. I can write in the following way as sum over all configurations of M. So now I've completely removed, gotten rid of variable theta, right? But this is not, unfortunately, the whole story. M, I, mu are just intermediate variables for now. And then so I have my partition function in terms of variables M. So I have a conservation law on every side, so delta mu, mi mu for every I and mu. And then I have this e to minus t divided by 2j sum over I and mu, mi mu squared, okay? Okay, now, so it's inconvenient to kind of just enforce this constraint by hand on every side, but I can solve for M in terms of some other variable so that this constraint is satisfied automatically, right? So if I take, again, using continuum notation, if I take M, vector M, to be equal to gradient of some other vector of some field n, which is also integer, cross z, where z is again the normal to this plane, then divergence of m is zero automatically. Okay, this implies then that divergence of m is always zero. Okay, so let's see how this is actually defined on the lattice. Okay, so on the lattice, I have to define those variables n on the dual lattice, the lattice that's dual to the original. So let's see how this works. So here is my original square lattice, and as you remember, the variables M are defined on the bonds of this lattice. Okay. Now let me define what's called dual lattice. So the dual lattice is just the same square lattice, but its vertices now are located at the centers of plaquettes of the original lattice. Okay. So I have another square lattice with vertices at the centers of plaquettes. So for square lattice, this dual lattice happens to be square. For other lattice types, this is not the case. So for example, if I take a hexagonal lattice, or triangular, as it's called, then dual to triangular lattice is honeycomb, and so on. But for square lattice, it's exactly the same lattice. So let me draw its bonds in this way, my dashed lines. And so then the way I will write this relation here is the following. So let's say I have a particular bond. So this is I, and this direction is mu. Right, so I have. Let's say this is just x, right? So this I take this horizontal bond here, right? So I will take a field N, fields N on the ends of bond of the dual lattice, which crosses this particular bond of the direct lattice. And then I'll say that MIX here, right? So this is going to be MIX is equal to the difference between variables N defined on this bond of the dual, defined at the sites of the dual lattice at the end of this perpendicular bond, right? So I can write this as, let's say, so this is going to be N I plus, so this is going to be I plus x plus y over 2, right? Plus x hat plus y hat over 2 minus, this is going to be N I plus x minus y over 2. Okay? So this is the the way I redefine my variables. And so again, I am not going to do this explicitly. It's a very simple exercise to check that with this redefinition of variables m, this is always satisfied. Delta mu m I mu is equal to 0. Okay. Sorry?
Could you repeat what is M and M in the picture?
So M are these integers, M. So I've just rewritten my partition function of the original model formally in terms of these integers, right? Mm-hmm. These are just, you know, Fourier. So these are related to variable theta by Fourier transform, right? Mm-hmm. So this is like, you know, if I do Fourier transform in real space, if theta is position, then this would be analog of momentum, way back then. But now, so I have this constraint that on every site I, I have this zero divergence condition for the variables M. So in order to not to deal with this constraint, because it's complicated, I can just solve for M in this way, which makes this zero divergence condition satisfied automatically. Mm-hmm. So you can check that if I define M to be, if I redefine M like this, then indeed zero divergence condition will be satisfied automatically. Okay, so let me just do the first step of this.
Sorry, what is in I plus?
Sorry?
What is in I plus?
What is it? So this is just coordinates of the dual lattice, right? So let's say I are coordinates of the vertices in the direct lattice, right? Now I want to, but the variables N are defined on the dual lattice.
Okay.
So the coordinate of this thing is I plus X over 2 plus Y over 2, right? So how will you solve this? So okay, so let's calculate the divergence, the total divergence for this of variables M, which are attached to this site, right? So I would have M I X hat, right, plus M I Y hat. Minus now, so you have to be careful with signs here. So minus M I minus X hat, so this is this, this is this bond here, right? And I'm taking this with minus sign because the variables M have direction, right? So they are labeled by I and the unit vector. So therefore, if I'm counting them from this side, right, the head of this bond is going into this side. Therefore, I count it with the minus sign. Okay, so this is one subtlety here. And then the same thing for this bond, which is going to be minus M, so I minus y hat, okay? And so if I rewrite those m's in this way, then you will easily see that this is just identically zero, okay? All of those ands just cancel between each other. Okay? And so then, in terms of the variables n, the partition function can be rewritten in the following way. So z is equal to sum over m, over n now, okay, and there is no constraint anymore. And then e minus t divided by 2j, right, sum over I and mu, where I are now sides of the dual lattice, and mu are directions on the dual lattice, well, which are the same as the directions on the original lattice. And then, so each m is basically transformed into a gradient of n. So therefore, again, I'll skip a couple of minor details here, but you can show that this is just rewritten as delta mu and I squared, okay? Okay? So this now looks like it's a nice and simple model, right? So this is called a discrete Gaussian model, right? It's Gaussian because it's quadratic in n, right? And if n was a real variable, this would be just, you know, this would be very nice. This would be an exactly solvable, an easily exactly solvable model, right? Because we could just integrate over n. It would be Gaussian integral. But the problem is that it's discrete. Problem is that n's are integers. Okay, since I've used them to redefine another variable that was integer, clearly n has to be an integer. Okay? That's why it's discrete. Okay? So so this is basically, so far, this is exact dual. Okay, so what we've gone through so far is what's called duality transformation. Okay. And this is exact dual of our original model. Okay? We haven't really made any approximations so far, or at least not any important approximations. Okay. So one interesting feature here that's common to all dual pairs, right, is that so in the original model I had j over t, right? So in my original partition function, let me just reproduce that again. So I had product d theta I e to j divided by t cosine, or sum over I and mu cosine delta mu theta I, right? So this means, so t here was in the denominator, right? So this would mean that when t is small, right, the coefficient here would be large, right? And that just would penalize any non-zero gradients of theta, right? So that this coefficient being large would make the system order precisely, having theta to be uniform. So here t is in the, here the situation is the opposite, okay? So here t is in the numerator, right? And so the variables n, in fact, order at large t instead of small t. Okay? So the ordered phase of the original model in this way maps onto a disordered phase of the dual model and vice versa. Okay, so that's the kind of the point of the duality transformation, that you map ordered phase in one model onto disordered phase of the other model, and the other way around. Disordered phase high temperature phase into one model, into low temperature phase of the other model. That's the relation between the two models, which are related by duality transformation. Okay. And so these variables n are, as we will see, are very closely related already to the vortex variables, okay? To the vortex winding numbers. They are not yet exactly the vortex winding numbers, but they are very closely related to them. So, you know, and they are defined exactly where we want them to be defined on the sides of the dual lattice, which are centers of plaquettes of the original lattice, right? So that's precisely where the vortices live, right? Vortex is associated with plaquette, with elementary plaquette of the original lattice, right? Okay, so now let's just massage this model into a slightly nicer form, okay? Because, I mean, here, this is a very convenient form for numerical calculations because I have integer variables. That's very nice for numerics. But for, analytical work, this is not convenient, right? We cannot do RG on integer variables. Okay, so I want to transform this further a little bit. And what I will do is the following thing. So let me use the following mathematical trick. That's always useful if you want to convert from a sum to an integral. Okay, so I'll use what's called Poisson summation formula. Which you've probably seen many times, and this says that I can rewrite sum over integer n going from minus infinity to infinity of any function g of n in the following way, a sum over some other integer m, also going from minus to plus infinity, and then integral over a real variable, let me call this variable phi, also from minus to plus infinity, d phi g of phi e to minus 2 pi I m phi, right? So I basically replaced summation over n here by integration over a real variable phi, well, with the price that I also have to do a summation over another integer m, okay? But that's okay, okay? This just follows immediately from this representation for a delta function, which we've already used, that, you know, sum over m from minus infinity to infinity of e to minus 2 pi I m phi is just equal to sum over n from minus infinity to infinity delta of phi minus n. Okay? Well, we have not quite used it in this form, but so this immediately follows from here. Okay? I just simply rewrite the sum here using this thing in terms of integral over phi. Right? Okay, so let's apply this trick to the discrete Gaussian model. So if I do that, I'll get the following. So I get partition function as an integral from minus infinity to infinity. So now I have to introduce a real field phi for every side of the dual lattice, right? And then in addition, sum over M, but this is not, okay, sorry maybe for potential confusion, but this is not the same M as the M we had before. So that was just some intermediate M, while this M actually is important. That has physical meaning. And then I have E to minus T divided by 2J. So now this discrete gradient of N is replaced by gradient of phi.